Our next class, brethren and sisters, is being brought to us by Brother Mark Vincent from Boston. He's going to be talking this week on suffering, man's problem, and God's problem. Today we're going to be listening to him talking about bondage of corruption. Brother Mark.
Good morning, brothers and sisters.
Good morning.
I hope you're all prepared to suffer. I'd like to make three caveats before we begin our consideration of suffering and the problem of evil. The first one is that I have very little personal experience of suffering. I'm relatively young. I haven't really had any suffering in my life. And I'm very conscious of that as I speak on this subject. So you can, of course, come back to me and say, well, why are you speaking on it? And the rejoinder to that is because nobody else is very much, as far as I can tell. And yet suffering and pain is one of the most fundamental and universal parts of the human condition and human experience. The Bible has a lot to say about it. And as I said the other night, it's one of the key reasons that people give as an argument for not believing in God. So, you know, we ought to have something to say about it. I'm getting older, as we all are. I'm more aware of the, you know, I'm not as good physically at certain things as I used to be. And I think about death. Hopefully not an unhealthy amount. I don't think I think about it more than Anita does. She sometimes tells me I think about it too much. But I do think about it, as I'm sure we all do from time to time. And I've read a lot of books about suffering, and obviously done Bible study in preparation for these talks. So that's the reason why I'm talking about this subject. A second caveat is that this series of talks will be a theoretical series. It will be about how we rationalize, how we think about suffering. And I imagine, therefore, it will not be of much help, much practical help to someone who is suffering. It's a talk about the whys of suffering in a way rather than the how of suffering. It's about understanding rather than an emotional response to suffering. And yet, fundamentally, suffering is about how we do it. It's about how we react to it. It's about how we suffer. It would actually be more important for me to talk about how we suffer than it is to talk about these theoretical aspects, but I'm certainly not qualified to talk about the how, and so let's start with the why. And the third point, and this is the last of the caveats, we shall not completely understand this subject. If the book of Job tells us anything, and we shall look at the book of Job in quite some detail in the fourth talk, it tells us that we cannot necessarily understand or expect to understand or have any right to understand, ultimately, why any particular piece of suffering might occur. And there will be limits to the extent to which we can understand suffering as a whole. So these talks will be faith-seeking understanding, if you like. There are limits to how much we'll understand. We're not going to completely master this subject, but let's take some tentative steps together with our Bibles in our hands. One of the aspects of suffering that you will experience is that you won't be able to read my slides. But fortunately, it does get a little bit. It's only the title slides that are completely illegible, and the others are a little more so. One of the triggers for me looking into this subject was I came across this book by a New Testament scholar, fairly famous scholar called Bart Ehrman, called God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. That's what the question is, according to this book, our most important question, why do we suffer? That's another reason why we want to talk about it. And this book, this guy used to be a believer, and he stopped believing in God because he couldn't come to grips with the problem of suffering. And this book hit the New York Times bestseller list. It's the most recent popular treatment, as far as I'm aware, about the arguments for you should not believe in God because human beings suffer. You know, we can't reconcile a good God and the existence of evil in the world. So I thought this was a good foil to have. So I bought this book and read it. I don't recommend that you read it. It's not a good book. you know, I think if I wanted to make the arguments for not believing in God, I could probably make them better than this book does. But it's a good example of the, you know, the kind of arguments that people use, and it's got lots of statistics in it about suffering and so on that, you know, I've just been able to borrow and use. So in a way, I'm going to be trying to answer some of the arguments of this book implicitly as we go along. So let's just think for a second about how serious this problem is. During the course of time that we've been sitting in classes this morning, more than 700 children have died of hunger. Another 250 have died from unsafe water. 300 other people have died from malaria. And on top of that, there are the people who have been tortured, murdered, trafficked in, those people who have come newly upon poverty, babies have been born with birth defects, people have died in car accidents, children have been diagnosed with leukemia, divorces have happened, families have been broken down, just in that short period of time as we've been sitting here, all that has happened. And so Paul was absolutely right, wasn't he, when he spoke about the whole creation groaning and travailing in pain together, and those statistics about just the deaths of children just remind us how real that groaning and that travailing of our world really is. So here are some of the arguments that an unbeliever might put to us, and you know, it's very difficult when they give you, we're just going to spend a few minutes thinking about, you know, how an unbeliever would put the argument and how we might respond. It's very difficult when they put the argument in these kinds of ways to respond, you know, in a sort of 30-second answer. You need longer than that, don't you, to explain about God's purposes and about the implications of free will and all that stuff. It takes some time. So it's very hard to give an answer to some of these quite glib points. I just want to point out sort of how the argument is made. As you well know, you'll have heard these arguments, and also some of the unspoken assumptions and mistakes within the argument itself. So think about the first two. If God is a perfect father, what would we think of a human father who beats up his children, who makes them suffer, or who stands by being able to prevent the suffering, but stands by and refuses to do so? What would we think to a human father who saw his children being beaten up and the father just stands there watching it happen? And isn't that what God is doing when, you know, those, what was it, 700 children die of hunger within the last hour or so? If God is a father, what would we think of a human father who feeds some of his children but not others? You know, suppose I gave food to my son but not to my daughter. What would we think of a human father who did that? We would say that was unacceptable, and yet isn't that, in a sense, isn't that what God is doing? But can you spot one of the weaknesses of the way that those arguments are expressed? They assume that the entire basis of God dealing with human beings can be explained on the model of God as a human father, don't they? And although it's true that God is like a father and is a father, he is not only like what a human father is like. He is also a Lord and a God, isn't he? A God who is of too pure eyes to behold iniquity. So we can't build our argument purely on the basis of saying, using this human analogy of God being a father. Yes, God is a father, but he's also a Lord and a God who has standards and who has a purpose to which he is working. And we would need to consider that too, wouldn't we, before we could really say whether or not this argument was valid. Have a look at point three there. If God is a God of love, why does he stand by while so much suffering takes place? And again, you see, the way the question is phrased has a problem in it. If God is a God of love, and that argument assumes that all we can say about God is that he is a God of love. But of course, we know that God isn't just a God of love. God is also a God of righteousness and purity, a God who has a purpose, a God who has delegated free will to men and women. And there are implications of that. So it's not just a matter of saying if God is a God of love, is it? That's only part of the story about God, just as God being a father is only part of the story. So we need to be aware when people present these kinds of arguments to us that, you know, there are actually problems inherent in the way they're presenting the argument. There are weaknesses. That their argument doesn't present the whole story. Let's just think for a minute, if we flip it round and say, well, suppose God didn't exist, then what would we have then? Well, C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Problem of Pain, points out what the world would be like if that were the case. All stories will come to nothing. All life will turn out in the end to have been transitory and a transitory and senseless contortion upon the idiotic face of infinite matter. I like that quote. The idiotic face of infinite matter. If God doesn't exist, there's nothing. Nothing means anything, does it? Everything means nothing. That's all we are. That's all there is out there. A senseless contortion upon the idiotic face of infinite matter. And there's no difference between the death and the suffering of an earwig as there is between the death and the suffering of a human being. Because it's all just random chance, isn't it? And yet, the people who use the argument of suffering to argue that there isn't a God, the very basis of their argument is that they're outraged by human suffering. They say human suffering isn't right, human suffering shouldn't happen, human suffering is a terrible thing. And yet, if there isn't a God, human suffering doesn't mean anything, does it? It's just another irrelevance. Do you see the point there? I think that's quite an interesting point. The very fact that as human beings we feel things ought to be different, we oughtn't to suffer, and we oughtn't to meet the same fate as the beasts and the animals and the earwigs, tells us something about our nature and our potential. And the Bible tells us what that is. It's because we're made in the image of God. So if you go down this road of saying, well, suffering proves that God doesn't exist, then you shouldn't even be upset, should you, by any suffering in the world. It doesn't mean anything. It's just random. It's all just meaningless. But of course, we know better than that, because we know why human beings object to suffering. We know why they're outraged by it, because they have this sense that there must be more to life than this. There must be more to life than pain and suffering. There must be a reason why we're different from the animals and why we have so many greater capacities and so much more potential than they. And the Bible explains it's because God has a purpose with us. And that purpose, as it turns out, has involved suffering. I just want to make a quick point about C.S. Lewis here. I'm going to be showing a number of quotes of C.S. Lewis, and that's because I think he's the most quotable author who's ever written about suffering. Any book that I've ever picked up on the subject of suffering quotes C.S. Lewis time and again, and these talks are going to be no different. It's just because he had a way with words and a way of capturing things in a very powerful way. So you're going to see quotes from C.S. Lewis quite a lot. This is probably his most famous book, The Problem of Pain. It's a worthwhile book. It has some good, very good chapters in it. It has some chapters that are less good. But it's got useful things, and I'll be pulling some of those things out. How many people have read that book, just as a matter of interest? Just a couple. Okay. So let's think then from a perspective now of us as believers wanting to try to understand the problem of evil and the problem of suffering. What are we trying to understand? Well, here are some things that we will want to think about. Is it right that there should be pain? Should there be this much of it? That's the question about quantity, isn't it? Should there be pain at all? Should there be this much of it? Should it be spread so seemingly randomly? You know, according to whether I was born here or whether I happen to be born in Africa. Will make a huge difference, won't it, in terms of the quality of life that I'll have and the amount of physical suffering that I might be exposed to? Should it include babies, or should it only, you know, start at a certain age? How should we look at suffering when it comes, and what good can it do? Those are some of the things that we're going to be thinking about. And really, what this first talk is all about is talking about the implications of sin. So if we start with two assumptions, that God is a righteous God who has a purpose has a purpose with people who want to serve him, and also that we are sinners, then what do those two assumptions of themselves imply about our world? Does there have to be death? In a world with a righteous God who is too pure to behold iniquity, and yet with a world filled with sinners, well, of course there has to be death, doesn't there? Otherwise, you would have a world of immortal sinners. How can that be acceptable to God, given his righteousness and his holiness? That's not God's plan, is it, to have a world full of immortal sinners, you know, immortal Hitlers? Just think, good man versus an evil man, locked in eternal combat that would never end because neither of them could ever die. It's a ludicrous notion. And the world would eventually just be overcome with prisons, wouldn't it? Because we would just have to keep these people locked away permanently, and gradually there wouldn't be any space for the rest of us to live in. There has to be death in a world where there is a righteous God and sinners. God has to be able to bring their lives, the lives of sinners, to an end, and he does, and that's why he put in place the punishment that he put in place in Genesis 3. Dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. It couldn't be any other way. It has to be that way with our two simple assumptions. Does death have to be so unpredictable? Couldn't it just be, hypothetically, that, you know, we all lived our lives swimmingly and everything went along fine, there was no pain or suffering or anything until our 70th birthday, and then we suddenly plopped down dead on our 70th birthday? Or, you know, we died in our sleep on the last day of 69. Could we imagine a world like that? Well, people would just do whatever they wanted, wouldn't they, until the very day before they knew they were going to die. And then there would be all these instant repentances, these conversions, these deathbed conversions, just an instant before it was too late. Is that the sort of world that would be conducive for God to produce a people with whom he could have an eternal spiritual relationship? We know what we're like, don't we? Why would you pay any attention until the last moment? We're just too selfish. Well, I think that thinking along those lines helps us with the next question as well. Does death have to be random in its manner? Isn't it the very fact that we don't know what will happen? We know there are so many possible outcomes, some of them relatively pleasant and able to be coped with, and some of them very unpleasant and involving pain and sadness. Isn't it the very uncertainty that makes us think? That makes us think about our future, about what might happen, and about what we ought to be doing about it? Doesn't the very seemingly chaotic and random nature of our world, the fact that we don't know what we'll be and how we will die and how we might suffer or how we might not, isn't it that makes us think? And of course, if we are creatures who will one day die and must one day die because of our sins, then we must be able to die, mustn't we? We must have parts that wear out, and that of itself involves pain. It's just a logical consequence of it. It involves suffering, because on some people, some parts will wear out quicker than others, and we know that's what happens. There must be obsolescence built into us as human beings, mustn't there, so that one day we can die, as we must. And sometimes people use a different argument. They say, well, couldn't God create a world in which there was a sort of instant pain model? So as soon as I was about to do something evil, suppose I was just about to punch someone, as my arm went forward, suddenly I would have a searing pain in my arm, and so I wouldn't do it. Well, we would end up being like robots, wouldn't we? You know how Pavlov's dogs, he trained them by stimulus to do various things, and apparently pigeons can be taught to play table tennis if you give them the right... I've never personally witnessed that, but apparently it is possible. You know, you give animal stimuluses. Some of us went down to the aquarium at Mystic yesterday and we saw the sea lions doing their tricks when they're given the right stimulus. But that's not creatures freely choosing to serve their master for what he is it? That's a creature saying, okay, well, I won't do what I really want to do because I know my arm's going to hurt if I do. And so we would become kind of robots. That's not the kind of free choice that God wanted us to make. And something else too. Suppose my arm hurt as I was about to punch, so I didn't, so I don't raise my arm. But does that stop me thinking evil thoughts about that person that I want to punch if only my arm didn't hurt? No, of course not. My mind would be consumed with what I would want to do to that person if only I could. But doesn't God care about our thoughts too? My life would be spent in agony, wouldn't it? Because of all the evil thoughts that I think. I would just be going around constantly, shrieking out and praying. Because of that. So this instant pain model that people sometimes suggest, that doesn't work either, does it? God has chosen the model that works, surprise, surprise, because he's rather wise at doing things like that. God has made the world like this for his particular purpose of gathering for himself a people. So let's think then, let's get our Bibles out now and quickly go to Genesis 3 and remind ourselves where this all began. Genesis 3 and verse 16, the punishment of the woman, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. So God now introduces sorrow into the world. And the sorrow here is specifically linked to childbirth, but I think it's not just the process of, you know, the actual delivery of the baby, but it's also the, you know, the care and the anxiety that a woman has as a mother for the rest of her life. It never goes, does it? A mother will always be concerned for her children and anxious for them. And, you know, perhaps as well, you know, things like birth defects, perhaps they're included here in the sorrow of bringing forth children. And then the pain in the relationship with respect to the man is brought out there, the desire to thy husband, and he will rule over thee. Let's go to the punishment of Adam in verse 17. Cursed is the ground for thy sake, in sorrow thou shalt eat of it all the days of thy life. And so he has sorrow too, as he eats his bread in that meaningless way, only to die and to return to the dust. So the very substance from which he comes then, and we might see that as representing the man's nature then, and God's curse falls upon the ground there out of which he was taken. And there are obstacles now to his existence. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. And again, we might think of that very literally, of thorns and thistles, or it might be possible to see that more metaphorically, of stumbling blocks and obstacles of a more general kind, of the frustrations that occur in human life. And a lot of the suffering that we have is related to some of those obstacles and frustrations. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken. For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Let's go to Ecclesiastes and have a quick look there. I think the book of Ecclesiastes is very powerful for the way that it captures what our world is like. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 23. I think you can see the book of Ecclesiastes in a way as a kind of expansion on Genesis 3. you know, with all the sorrows and meaninglessness that now ensues because of our choices to move away from God. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 23. For all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This also is vanity. That's how the preacher characterizes human life. Sorrows and travail. And his heart takes not rest in the night. And we know what it's like, don't we? You know, I'm sure we've all had sleepless nights where something has disturbed us or upset us, or maybe because of pain that we couldn't sleep. That's how life is. It's right, isn't it? This also is vanity. And it's a vanity that, if we look back a second in chapter 1 and verse 13, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. Do you see that? God has given this travail to us to be exercised with it. It's not an accident that the world is like that, with all that vanity in it, with all that sorrow and travail and pain and meaninglessness. God has made the world like that deliberately so that we might say, how come? How come I have this longing for something more, this longing for eternity? The book of Ecclesiastes says that we were built for eternity in a way. God has put eternity in our hearts. We long for it. And yet, we're surrounded by all this meaninglessness, all this vanity and sorrow. God has done it to exercise us with it. And exercise, hopefully, makes you better at something, doesn't it? What is it making us better at? Is it making us discern the difference between man's way and God's way, and therefore make the right choices? Let's have a look at chapter 3 and verse 10. He makes the same point. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, here is that verse. Also, he hath set the world or eternity in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Notice there it was in verse 10. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men. So it's not an accident that the world has worked out this way. God has made the world like that deliberately so that we might question ourselves and ask ourselves, what is wrong here? What is going wrong? And that brings us to a sort of legible slide. What I've done through these talks is to collect together a number of principles. Now, I make no great claim for these principles. There are probably other principles that could also be chosen, but these are some of the ones that have occurred to me and seem to me to be important with respect to the problem of suffering. And this is the one of the most important, and I've called it the pain principle. There is a message in human suffering. God has put that travail, that sorrow, into the world deliberately. It was there in Genesis 3. God gave sorrow to the woman and he gave sorrow to the man. He has made our lives painful. Why has he done it? Because he wants us to realize that something is wrong and therefore to do something about it. Now, I don't mean that something is wrong with you specifically as a person. Therefore you got that headache because you did such and such a thing. You put too much dessert on your plate. Not at that level, but at the general level of human society, we experience pain and sorrow because something is wrong with us, because we're sinners in God's sight. Now, it's interesting to just explore pain, the phenomenon of pain, in a little bit more detail. Why do we have pain at all? Well, that's it, exactly. That pain tells us that something is wrong. I put my hand on something that's hot and I feel pain, so I take my hand away. Because if I don't, that skin will be destroyed and it will never be the same again if I don't take it away quick enough. And then if I keep it there longer, then it'll go all the way through the tissues, won't it, until gradually all I'm left with is the bone itself. That's why God has put a pain mechanism into our bodies. Philip Yancey, in his book on suffering, I can't just think of the title of it now, but he has a great section about how powerful and amazing the human pain system is. And he came at that from a man, Dr. Paul Brand, who did a lot of work with the victims of leprosy. And I'm not talking now about the leprosy in the Bible, that's a different disease. I'm talking about what we would call leprosy today, Hansen's disease. And the real problem with leprosy is that the victims no longer feel pain. And so they do things that they oughtn't to do because it will inflict harm upon them. And so they, you know, if you're trying to, you try and open a jar or something that you can't open, if you, eventually it will start to hurt, won't it? Or you try and turn a key in a lock that won't turn. Ultimately, you'll let go and stop turning because it's hurting too much. But these people won't do that. They'll just keep on turning and they will ruin their joints and their hands from things like that. And that's ultimately how they lose, you know, they lose their fingers and then they lose their limbs. And that's why, it's because their bodies don't feel the pain that the rest of us feel. So they don't let go, they don't get the warning signals, and therefore they don't take the appropriate remedial action. God has built pain into us at the purely physical level to protect us. You know, we have a headache, that tells us there's something wrong. Maybe we need to take a rest, close our eyes a minute, stop staring at the computer screen, whatever it is. Pain tells us that there's something wrong. I mean, and there was there's another condition called congenital indifference to pain. And I read a sad story about a girl who was born with this. And her mother came and found her one day writing on her sheets in her cot in her own blood. She'd bitten off her finger and had no pain in it. And of course, how do you now discipline that child? Because there are no threats that work, because she doesn't feel any pain. And if she's not getting away, what does she do? She puts a body part in her mouth and bites it. And she'd lost all her digits by the time she was a teenager. I mean, it's tremendously sad, but it makes the point very powerfully, doesn't it, about the pain principle. There is a message in human suffering. There is something wrong with us. All is not well in the world. And by reading our Bibles, we know what went wrong, and we know what we must change to be in a good relationship with God. Let's then go to Romans chapter 8. There are a lot more references in Ecclesiastes that are, you know, great on this subject, but we need to move on. And Romans 8 is fascinating on this. And of course, the brother in his prayer last night picked up a lot of the points from Romans 8. And Romans 8 builds both on Genesis 3 that we looked at and on the book of Ecclesiastes. And all the language of travail and vanity and groaning from Romans 8, where does it come from? It comes from those two places. It comes from Genesis 3 and it comes from Ecclesiastes. It's like, you know, one of these golden threads that goes through the scriptures. Let's have a look at verse 18. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creature, of the creation, that should read, the earnest expectation of the creation waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. So the creation is waiting for something. The trouble is, it doesn't know what it's waiting for, does it? People out there know there's something wrong, they know there's a problem, but they don't know the origin of that problem, and they don't know why they're experiencing it. And that's our job to tell them as preachers. So creation is waiting expectantly, J.B. Phillips translates it, as on tiptoe, as if the world is on tiptoe waiting for something better to happen. We know what that something better is. For the creation, verse 20, was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope. So God didn't want to give us all this pain. He gets no pleasure from our pain. But it had to be this way. God had to subject the creation to this vanity that Ecclesiastes talks about in order that we might see the lesson, take the message from the pain and suffering of this world, and then order our lives aright in God's sight. And we've got free choice, completely free choice, whether or not we do that or not. The message is there. The signal is there. God's not forcing us to do it. He's not giving me a pain when I reach out my fist. And yet the evidence is still as powerful if we can discern it. Because, verse 21, the creation itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption unto the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. So we're under now this bondage of corruption. The whole creation groans and travails in pain together. God has made it that way. But what does the metaphor of travail, of groaning in pain, all this chapter is about, or this section, is about childbirth. Remember what Jesus said about a woman when she's in labor with a child has sorrow. But when the baby's born, the intensity of that sorrow is, it's over, isn't it? And it was worth going through for the wonder of the newborn child. And the creation now is groaning and travailing like a woman in labor. And we know how tense and how painful that can be for all concerned. And the world that we live in is undergoing that now. But something is going to happen out of the end of it. You needn't turn this up, but I just want to quickly read you from John 16, 21 and 22. And Jesus picks up on this very notion. A woman, when she is in travail, hath sorrow because her hour is come. But as soon as she is delivered with child, she remembereth no more the anguish for joy that a man has been born into the world. And ye now therefore have sorrow. But I will see you again, and your heart shall rejoice, and your joy no man taketh from you. Even we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit, as Paul put it in Romans 8, we've got pain and sorrow and travail too, haven't we? We're talking about that with Brother Dev. We're talking about it again now. We know all about what that's about. But there's a purpose to it. It's going to lead somewhere. It's going to lead to this glorious redemption. But I will see you again, says Jesus, and your heart shall rejoice, and your joy no man taketh away from you. Just give me 1 second to... I just want to, again, let's have another quote from C.S. Lewis here, which just enlarges upon why this pain principle is necessary, why the world has to be this way. The human spirit will not even begin to try to surrender self-will as long as all seems to be well with it. You know, if there were no pain and suffering and everything was just one big party, why would we think of God and seek a relationship with Him? The illusion of self-sufficiency must, for the creature's sake, be shattered. Someone else said, self-sufficiency pulls us like a magnet away from God. And when we suffer, self-sufficiency is the first thing that goes out of the door, isn't it? And pride, and those things that are obstacles to our relationship with God. And then he goes on in this final quote on this page to talk about a time when he was ill. And, you know, he suddenly got seriously ill for a very short time, 48 hours, and he thought about God rather a lot that time while he was ill. God had me for 48 hours, and then only by dint of taking everything else away from me. And isn't it sad that we're like that? You know, isn't it a shame that it might have to be like that? So, let's learn the lessons, not at the individual level, but let's learn the lessons generically from the suffering and pain and sorrow and travail and anguish that we witness in the world, that there is a message behind it, that God is telling us something about our nature and about His plan for us. Is another quote that I really like. God wants to give us something, but cannot, because our hands are full. There's nowhere for Him to put it. Isn't it the very shortcomings of this life? Isn't it that very travail, that vanity, that makes us care about what it is that God wants to give us? And these slides and quotes, by the way, I assume that we can maybe put this presentation up on the Bible School website or something ultimately. Is that okay, Jeff? Think so, yeah. If not, then obviously you can email me and I can send it. Let's draw things to a conclusion. We need to think a little bit about this. We hide death away, don't we? Death is a kind of taboo. We can talk about sex. We can say anything we want about sex now, and no one bats an eyelid in society at large. But death is still a taboo. We like to pretend that there isn't. We don't want to look at that suffering. It's too painful to look at it. And so we live in a kind of sanitized, sterilized environment. And we think that, there's this assumption built into society that somehow we deserve a life of happy holidays and creature comforts and big houses and fast cars and, all that stuff. We are worth it. That's the L'Oreal advertising slogan, isn't it? Because you're worth it. And yet the Bible tells us something different. In a way, there's none good, is there? There is none good but one, and that is God. And what we really deserve is death. So we need to make sure we're thinking the right way about this. In a way, the problem isn't the problem of suffering. The problem is the problem of pleasure. How come God has allowed us so much pleasure and so many good things in life, given what we're like as sinners before Him? And that's the wonder of His grace, that He's given us so many good things to enjoy. So we live in a particularly deadly environment now, in which the suffering that we will experience has gone right down because of modern medicine that's available to us in this country. The suffering has gone right down, and our comforts have gone right up because the standard of living has gone up so much. And there's a danger that we forget about the pain principle, that we forget about the pain that there is in this world, because we can sort of hide away from it so easily in modern life in the US and pretend that it wasn't there, and not face the harsh realities of life. But God wants us to face them. Let's conclude with this second principle for this morning's class, the God is not fair principle. So many of the arguments from unbelievers, or the arguments about the problem of pain, say, this person couldn't have deserved this. They work on the assumption that we deserve all good things, but as we've already said, even Jesus would not call himself good. Do we really want fairness? Do we really want to use the it's not fair argument? If we want fair, then we'd all be dead, wouldn't we? The grace of God is not fair, it's grace. It's not deserved. It's by God's goodness. Fair for humans may involve death rather sooner than anyone would hope. I want to perhaps just conclude then with this slide. The chaos and unpredictability of our world, that travail, that vanity, mirrors the chaos that we have unleashed on the world through sin. In the end, we have to trust that God has got the quantity of the evil right, and that He's got the balance right between hands-off and hands-off management, and that He has stood back. He's given us free will and stood back to allow us to do our thing so that we can learn what the consequences of that are, and so that we might reach out to Him again. And this talk was deliberately in first place because unless we get the concept of our status before God, a righteous God, and ourselves as sinners, and the implications of our being sinners, given that God wants to redeem us, unless we get that right as first base, then, we can't ever really get our heads around the problem of suffering, I don't think. That's the foundation. That's what we are. We deserve death. God has been very gracious to us. And in the pain that there is in this world, there is a very important message from God, a message that we might seek after Him once again.